Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, criminal indictments mark a new phase in the Russia investigation. This hour, we want to take a look back at history, at crimes, scandals throughout presidential history. Joining us to do that, Tim Walch is presidential historian, also retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, joins me in the Iowa City studio. Welcome back, Tim.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be with you.
Carrie Covington is with us by phone, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, how you doing?
We had you two on last time, had such a good time putting the present, not so much a show about this facet of the presidency, which, you know, the news is giving us daily developments about, but to take this as a leaping off point to set this in a historical context. So I know both of you have many examples going back through history, some of which we will know, but perhaps not know well, some we've never heard of. And that's what we're going to do this hour. And we want to reach out to our listeners to ask you what questions you may have about the past presidents who've been mired in scandal that we'll talk about this hour. 1-866-780-9100. You can email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. First of all, gentlemen, I wanted to ask before we get into some – go back to the 1800s – ask if you have any initial thoughts, broadly speaking, about scandal in the presidency in historical context before any individual cases. Tim Walch.
Yes. I think the most important thing to realize is that scandal is a very flexible word and a judgmental opinion in many cases. So that the opponents of a president often will define something as a scandal and the president's defender will say, oh, it was merely an error. So, for example, you have a situation – let's take, for example, the Obama administration, and it often is said to be scandal-free. Well, Republicans or the president's opponents might suggest, well, what about Benghazi or what about the IRS scandal or what about the rollout of Obamacare? All these they define, Republicans might define as scandals to be further investigated. And of course, we recall hour upon hour related to Benghazi didn't lead to any indictments or any prosecution. So we have to keep in mind that both sides have a very different opinion of what is a scandal depending upon who's in office at the time. Mm-hmm. The other thing I wanted to stress is the fact that often scandals involve not necessarily the president directly. Of course, that was the case in Watergate. There was no question there. But in many cases, going back to the 19th century and even up through the 20th, it's the people the president has chosen to serve in office. You know, Warren Harding used to worry – it was once asked if he worried about all the attacks from his enemies. And I'm paraphrasing here. And he said, no, it's not my enemies I have to worry about. It's my damn friends. And it is the friends from Marion, Ohio, the Ohio gang who were corrupt and associated with him. Or let's take U.S. Grant, the man who led us through the Civil War. Does anyone remember Orville Babcock, who was the president's assistant, who seemed to be involved in about half a dozen different scandals, and yet Grant defended him? I mean, that's a kind of loyalty that's sort of a character flaw. So it is often presidents who are blamed for being associated with people in their administration who are guilty, and many of the scandals that we talk about are, in fact, not the president, not in the Oval Office per se, mm-hmm. but in the executive branch.
Carrie Covington, anything to add initially, broadly speaking, to what Tim had to say?
Yeah, I think that it's important to realize that scandal is often in the eye of the beholder, and that what makes it important is when both sides will agree that something seriously wrong has happened. But beyond that, yeah, I think that's the important point. And the other idea is the presidency has become much more of a corporate institution over the last 50 years or so, many more people working there now. So oftentimes what happens isn't the president's direct involvement, but other people in the White House. Along the ideas of the people you have to fear are the zealots on your own side.
Right.
That they'll take things too far.
And right. And a president either takes ownership or doesn't. We know Truman and the buck stops here.
Right.
Other presidents will say, it's your fault, not my
that's,
fault.
That's right. Reagan
said, you know, it happened on my watch, and it's my responsibility, when he was talking about Iran-Contra. But ultimately, the presidency is a very personalized office, and there's one person at the top, and whatever happens under his watch is going to ultimately come back to him.
Okay. Tim Walsh, take us back to the 1800s. This is right after the U.S. Civil War. We have...
Right. The U.S. Grant became president by acclamation. Certainly, perhaps the great war hero of the Union Army, and knew many great men who showed honor and dignity in their service to their country in the military. And people had high expectations for that administration. But almost from the get-go, we had one scandal after another. And by my calculation, at least a dozen different scandals in the Grant administration, beginning with something called Black Friday, which was an effort to control the gold market. People might remember the name Jim Fisk or Jay Gould, and they were basically convincing President Grant not to sell gold, which artificially jacked up the price of gold, and they had cornered gold and gold stocks. And so that became the first black mark against the Grant administration. There was a custom house controversy in 1872 and going on. What is, I suppose, ironical in a way is the one scandal that tends to be more closely associated with Grant than any others is the Credit Mobilier crisis, which was a kind of a stock kiting scheme between the Union Pacific Railroad and this construction company, Credit Mobilier, in which members of Congress were given stock in the Union Pacific Railroad in exchange for various contracts. And it included the Vice President of the United States. And you might say, well, this is taking it right to the Oval Office. But this was a time Schuyler Colfax, who was Vice President of the United States, had an office in the Capitol and was more closely associated, of course, with the Senate than he was with Grant. So Grant had almost nothing to do with the Credit Mobilier crisis. But when people study American history these days, because it happened during the Grant administration, Credit Mobilier is something that that is tied to him as well.
When we go back over 100 years to the 19th century to look at a Credit Mobilier scandal, mm-hmm. For instance, is there a way, Tim, to know if that was this had this sort of all-consuming nature that we have today in our scandals, that it's what everybody talks about when they go to work, or a lot of people?
Well, and keep in mind, this is the era, the great era of newspapers, and I don't say yellow journalism quite at that point, but partisanship in terms of the press. And so that crises like that, and then cartoonists like Thomas Nast, who draw these incredible caricatures of various people, and these often show up in textbooks. And so the Credit Mobilier crisis will be displayed in drawings and so forth. It tended to grip people on a daily basis in terms of what they were reading. This takes a real shift once we have, of course, televised hearings, because it is Congress that's often investigating these malfeasance or the greed or what have you. And so you have, beginning in the 1950s, of course, with the popularity of television, you have congressional hearings being something like soap operas, as we know from Army McCarthy or Watergate.
Let's take a small step out of the 19th century into the early 20th century, and a scandal that most of us have not heard of, wouldn't know the first thing about, has an adorable name, Teapot Dome.
That's right. Does anybody remember Albert Fall, who was Secretary of the Interior, who arranged to sell petroleum reserves to two multimillionaire oil supporters of the president, Harry Doherty, or Harry Sinclair, and I think Edwin Doherty. I can't remember his first name, but Edward Doherty, or Doheny, excuse me. I'm getting their names wrong. Basically, it was a bribe to give them this insider deal on selling off this petroleum. What people don't realize is, although this crisis is associated, Teapot Dome and another oil reserve is associated with Warren Harding. But by the time this became known, Harding had died. He died in August of 1923. I think the crisis really becomes public in October. So in effect, Harding escapes he's still blamed for it by history, but he wasn't embarrassed by it in life. There had been previously a crisis in Harding's administration with the Veterans Administration construction of VA hospitals, which again was one of these deals that that one of his Ohio gang friends had manipulated. And then the same is true in the Justice Department. I guess attorneys were in the Justice Department were taking bribes and the Attorney General and so forth. And this materializes in 1924. So poor Warren Harding has passed on. He kind of lightly skated over the presidency while his friends are replenishing their bank accounts, passes away suddenly, unexpectedly, of a heart attack, and then his character has been pretty much put him in the dumpster. He's certainly at the very bottom, along with Grant. You want to guarantee yourself the lowest rung of, yeah, of presidential evaluation. It's going to be because you've had a scandal associated with your name.
Okay.
But Teapot Dome is a place, is a low physical location in Wyoming, I think it is.
Let's right. Did you have anything to add to that, Carrie?
No, no, okay. No. That was very good.
Let's, because I know the more modern era is, yes, is your wheelhouse, Carrie. Let's move into what we would say the modern era of the presidency to Eisenhower. We have a little bit of audio here to share. This has to do with the McCarthy hearings. Set this up. This is the 1950s.
Right.
Take us back there. We're going to hear a famous bit of audio, which is "Have You No Decency?"
Right.
Is a very short clip, but give us some significance here and the meaning of the culmination here we're going to hear in the audio clip in just
a
moment.
Just I'll talk briefly and then make Carrie can add to this. This is mid-1950s, I think 54, 55. It's a time, the early days of television. The hearings involved Senator Joseph McCarthy and a Senate Committee on Investigations. He had to step aside as chair. So he was basically accused of having pressured the Army to try to provide special privileges to somebody who had worked on his staff, David Shine. But at any rate, he got caught up in an argument with Joseph Welch, who was an attorney from Boston who had been hired by the Army to defend the Army. And McCarthy, kind of in a rather nasty way, began to attack and question the credibility and loyalty of a fellow named Fisher, who was an attorney working with Welch, because Fisher had been in the National Lawyers Guild, I think it was called, which was a communist organization, mm-hmm, or thought to be communist organization. And Welch just had it. He was fed up with McCarthy, and that's where the audio comes in.
Okay, let's listen to this.
Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator. Look, you've done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?
And so the public hears that, and what does that do to the national conversation and the judgment,
right,
about what Senator McCarthy was doing?
For the
doing?
First time, you know, they've been reading about Joe McCarthy in the newspapers, crusading Joe McCarthy. There are 200 and some odd communists in the State Department, and I'm going to root them out. And he did have sizable support throughout the country. But for the first time, they saw McCarthy on television, and he has this sort of 5 o'clock shadow and this snarl. He seemed to be like Snidely Whiplash on steroids, kind of. He made a poor presentation, poor impression. And when in effect, Welch said, "Have you no decency?" the audience in the hearing room stood up and applauded. And it was the beginning of the end for Joe McCarthy. He had other personal problems. He was
right,
an alcoholic and so forth. But this basically said, we are not going to, as Americans, tar and smear one another. The crisis or scandal had more to do, of course, with Congress. It did touch the Army. It didn't really affect Eisenhower or Eisenhower's reputation at all. But it's the first time, and it's important to realize how important television was to providing the American people with a window on these scandals. And as I say, because ABC and the Dumont Network really didn't have anything else to show, they covered it gavel to gavel, and mm-hmm, people were riveted the way they were for the Watergate hearings.
Right. Yeah, I think what it did is it showed him to be a bully,
yeah,
and the public could identify with him as a bully, and Welch is standing up to the bully. And as you say, in the media, he can be portrayed as a crusader, but on television, the pushing people around kind of side of him came through. Also, I'd point out that Eisenhower did catch some flack for not standing up to McCarthy. People were expecting presidents to lead in that time period, and he actually was criticized for not speaking up and then in leaving it to others to sort of stand up to this bully. So
That's a good point.
Let me hand off to you, Kerry Covington, after reminding our listeners that we're it's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, together with Kerry Covington of the University of Iowa, presidential historian Tim Walch, and we're looking at crime scandals throughout presidential history today. Let's remain in the 1950s and also the Eisenhower administration, I guess, here. We're going to hear, Kerry, and perhaps you can give us a little bit of context for what we're about to hear, Richard Nixon talk about a little puppy dog that they were given as a gift. What are we about to hear?
Well, Nixon had just been plucked out of the Senate after being there a very short time to be Eisenhower's running mate, and it came to light that he was having political expenses paid by some wealthy supporters, and that while he had been campaigning on the problem of corruption in the Truman administration, now he's engaging in activities that some might paint as corrupt, and because he was relatively new. I mean, he'd been in the House a couple of terms and then moved up to the Senate. Eisenhower had to rethink his support for Nixon as his running mate. So Nixon is sort of fighting for his political life, defending himself from these charges that he was sort of being bought by political supporters from California.
Okay, here it is. Richard Nixon, then Senator Richard Nixon, in his famous – part of his famous checker speech. I think it runs about a half an hour. An address he gave in on television, a special in September of 1952. Listen to then-Senator Richard Nixon pull at your heartstrings.
One other thing I probably should tell you, because if I don't, they'll probably be saying this about me, too. We did get something, a gift, after the election. A man down in Texas heard Pat in the radio mention the fact that our two youngsters would like to have a dog. And believe it or not, the day before we left on this campaign trip, we got a message from the Union Station in Baltimore saying they had a package for us. We went down to get it. You know what it was? It was a little Cocker Spaniel dog in a crate that he'd sent all the way from Texas. Black and white, spotted. And our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checkers. And you know, the kids, like all kids, love the dog. And I just want to say this right now, that regardless of what they say about it, we're going to keep it.
Okay. Expertly played, wouldn't you say, Kerry?
Oh. Oh, yeah. Yeah, very much picking out the one sort of a gift that he received that people could identify with.
And also the waver in his voice.
Yes.
And you know
yeah.
what it was?
Yeah.
You know, this was
well, and of course,
amazing.
Earlier in the speech, he talks about Pat having a good Republican cloth coat. She didn't have a mink coat. She just had a good Republican cloth coat. So he used that television appearance very, very well, and he understood the impact of television. The irony, of course, is television saved him, but then, of course, the Watergate hearings, television again, crushed him.
Right.
One
also,
other
also cost him the 1960 election.
Yes, it did cost
with,
him.
With the unshaven
indeed.
Facade.
Lived and died by television, death by a thousand cuts. I also want to make mention of somebody who we've forgotten, but at the time associated with the Eisenhower administration. Does anyone remember Sherman Adams, who was really the first modern chief of staff for a president in the Eisenhower administration? And I think during his Eisenhower's second term, he was caught up in a scandal where Adams' wife received a vicuna coat from a supporter named Bernard Goldfein. These are names that were in the press every day, and Adams had to resign for having accepted that gift. So although Nixon was saved by Pat's Republican cloth coat Sherman Adams was taken down by the fur coat that he didn't get. So the question of gifts comes up or privileges. We remember that John Sununu had to resign as George H.W. Bush's chief of staff for taking trips and using private aircraft, as we've seen problems with the Secretary Price and others leaving the Trump administration because of travel and privilege. And what do members of the president's cabinet get for being selected to serve?
Kerry, we have to take a break, and Tim, we have to take a break in a couple minutes. But first of all, before that, we're going to continue on sort of chronologically going here. We're up to the 1950s, entering the 1960s. This is kind of forecast what we're going to be talking about here, Kerry. We're going to be moving up into the Watergate era, which, of course, involves President Nixon at that time. And I guess a question that I would have when you pointed out some commonalities here, are there scandals in that broad sense of the term that we can look back on and say they forever after changed the office of the presidency or how we view the presidency? Kerry?
Yeah. Well, certainly Watergate is that sort of a event. I mean, the very idea that Gate becomes synonymous with scandal, and you just attach it to whatever thing you want to cast aspersions on, and you make it seem serious, shows you that that the Nixon event was sort of the premier.
I think I saw an article once that had there were more than 100 scandals that had been named with the suffix Gate.
I believe it.
That's right. Yeah, it's one of the things I think it, and Kerry's absolutely right. Watergate is really the paradigm shift in the presidency as far as our cynicism and skepticism about what people are doing in terms of personal gain and misuse of power. And also, I think it ratcheted up the determination of the media to investigate more deliberately that you have in those two reporters from the Washington Post, the beginning of an enormous change.
But it also goes hand in hand with what is uncovered about how we got into Vietnam and how we stayed in Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers.
Absolutely.
Hand in hand with Watergate, I mean, to unravel the two of those, changing, altering, and giving us a great mistrust of government.
Oh, I think without question. And I think you see that people are more and more skeptical of what they hear from presidents or what they hear from cabinet officers as to whether or not it really is going to benefit them. And they are always looking for change. I think we hunger for heroes, but then we're perpetually disappointed in the people we select for presidential office. There's a wonderful line that says, the American people have ample evidence to believe that they're being lied to, and that's just the way they like it.
All right. Tim Walz with us, presidential historian. Kerry Covington, political scientist from the University of Iowa. Kerry and Tim will be back with us after a short break. We'll talk about more scandals of the more contemporary nature. Watergate, maybe a few more words about that. Remember Iran-Contra? What about Whitewater? The Lewinsky investigation? Those are all yet to come. If you'd like to join our conversation with your questions about past presidents who've been mired in scandal, in the broad sense of that word, 1-866-780-9100. Back with Tim Walz and Kerry Covington. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, using the criminal indictments in the Russia investigation as a jumping-off point to talk about presidents' past, presidential history, when it connects with crimes, scandals in the White House. Perhaps we'll even talk about how congressional scandals can cast a shadow on the White House and impact the effectiveness of the chief executive officer of our country, the president. Kerry, let me go to you to start off this half hour. We've had a lot of this in the last few decades, but it didn't always used to be this way when we had personal lives, extramarital affairs, to put a fine point on it, be something that would pop up in certainly the Lewinsky scandal. But were there precursors to that? When did the press, when did we start paying attention to presidents' private lives in this way?
Right. Yeah, I'll be happy to talk about that. I just wanted to go back to Watergate for a minute to say that I think the negative effect, the dark effect that Watergate had on the country was even more pronounced in the sense that it didn't make us more skeptical, but it actually made us and our reporters more cynical. And cynicism is a really erosive, acidic way to look at politics. And when the people saw the president lying to them, and they saw the press let them down, it began to create a more cynical attitude towards politics. I think you can trace the decline in public trust in government back to this combination of Vietnam and Watergate. And you also see in the press a decided turn from sort of a more even-handed talking about the good things and the bad things to becoming increasingly oppositional, increasingly negative in the coverage of politics, and less talk about what is a good policy and what is a good policy and what is the merits, and more about the politics of who's benefiting and who's being helped or who's being reelected. I just don't think we can underestimate the negative effect that Watergate had, the corrosive effect it had on our political culture.
Right. And the older set listening today, joining this conversation, will remember a time when we would give the actions of a president or our Congress, our public servants, we would give them the benefit of the doubt.
Sure.
And then we turned the corner in the 1960s with Vietnam and Watergate. It sounds like you're telling me, Kerry, where we don't give them the benefit of the doubt, we are cynical and believe the worst first. That's our first sort of intuition
reaction. Yeah, I think that's very much the case. A political scientist did an interesting study of American government textbooks used in high schools and showed that in the 1950s and 60s, the presidents were virtually always portrayed in a benevolent, positive, progressive kind of way, that they were making the country better, more democratic, and that Watergate and Vietnam just upset that. And the president has lost that kind of gloss, where he's now seen as an advocate for those who share his views. But the idea of the president speaking for the whole country, I think you can see with Obama or Bush or Trump, their supporters think they're doing a great job, but virtually no one else. The public opinion of presidents has diverged dramatically on the basis of party over the last 20, 30 years, and I really think it has its roots back there in Watergate, Vietnam.
Kerry, let's go back to my original question
about
extramarital affairs, personal behavior by a president entering our discourse as something that matters when we evaluate a president.
Yeah, well, the press, again, this is before it became more cynical, more intrusive, used to grant presidents the privacy of their personal lives. I mean, it was an open secret among the press corps that Kennedy had affairs. I mean, the conditions under which Warren G. Harding supposed to have died might have involved a mistress. And those things were just not seen as worthy of public note. They were the president's personal matter, and what he did in office was what he did when he walked in the Oval Office and how he behaved there. That began to change. I think you can see people begin to see how you treat others in other situations as being more relevant. And where it really came to a head, I think it started with Ted Kennedy and the car accident in Chappaquiddick. But where it really blew up as far as a presidential politics goes was on Gary Hart when he was running for the Democratic nomination, and a local newspaper in Florida accused him of having an extramarital affair, and he, playing by the old rules, which is what's my business is my business and not yours, said, "Oh, no, I'm not. You can't prove it." And then they parked outside his mistress's home and showed him leaving, and then pictures came out later and totally blew him out of the water as far as being a candidate for president. And ever since, presidents have had to be very mindful of that. I mean, John Edwards got obliterated by his affair, and that's something that's very much on the minds of people today.
Right. And ever since the Gary Hart incident, I don't think there are a lot of boats being named Monkey Business.
Monkey Business, right, yeah.
Right. Right. So we have this also surface in the Whitewater affair, which morphs into something different, Tim Walsh, the Monica Lewinsky scandal. So one, how is one connected
well,
to the
this
other?
This is when you have a special counsel like that or a prosecutor that is given license to basically explore any line of inquiry related to a crime. You have, in effect, Whitewater, which was a land deal gone bad and who paid for what and what privileges were given, to a sexual scandal involving an intern. And I suppose it's kind of like chaos theory because the question becomes if Congress hadn't been shut down in 1995, I think it was, it might not have been the case that they had those interns, in effect, taking important positions or filling vacancies because everyone had to be sent home. And that's when the president made the acquaintance of Miss Lewinsky and chaos ensued. And in turn then there's gossip, which leads to inquiry by Ken Starr and the Republicans, and the president is called in to testify under oath, and he denies a sexual relationship with her, which kind of skirted the truth, and that further leads to impeachment charges in a partisan Congress, and it in effect lowered the level of high crimes and misdemeanors to sexual indiscretion, which I'm not saying is excusable, but it kind of tickled the puritanical fantasy we have in this country that we expect our presidents to be chaste and above board and without a character flaw.
Mm-hmm.
I think, to be fair, though, he wasn't charged with impeachment on for having an affair. He was charged with lying under oath.
Lying under oath, yes,
but which would be much more of an impeachable offense. But what he was lying about was certainly
was the affair.
Something not so significant, and also just to lay the background to that, the inquiry into Monica Lewinsky was actually spinning off not only the special prosecutor, but it was having to do with Paula Jones and other women who had accused the president of indiscretions in the past, and Monica Lewinsky comes up in that context, and now he's testifying under oath, and we know what came out of that for Clinton. Mm-hmm. The other point I think that's relevant to the current investigation, Robert Mueller's investigation, is that Nixon was investigated by a special prosecutor appointed out of the Justice Department, which is what led to the Saturday Massacre, where Nixon fired his attorney general and under attorney general because they wouldn't fire the special prosecutor. That led to the creation of the independent special prosecutor law, which is what Ken Starr was. And Ken Starr there is outside the president's realm of control. He can't be fired by the president. And the meandering and roundabout investigations that Ken Starr undertook led Congress to change the law back so that there wouldn't be this independent prosecutor. So we were to Mueller, and Mueller is, again, a special prosecutor coming out of the Justice Department, not independent. And that's what gives rise to people asking, well, will Trump fire Mueller? Ken Starr cannot be fired by the president. Mm-hmm. Mueller can. Hmm. And that's because of the rules we use to govern our special prosecutors and how they've changed over the last 30 years or so.
Kerry Covington is with us, political scientist at the University of Iowa. Tim Walsh, presidential historian. We're looking back at past presidents who have been mired in scandal. Got a few minutes left of this conversation. I wanted to take this off in a little bit different direction and play a little clip from a film that many of us will remember. Because I wanted to get into, Kerry and Tim, the idea that when a president becomes mired in scandal, any actions he takes, become or can be seen in a different light. Let's listen to this clip from the 1997 Oscar-nominated movie, Wag the Dog. Dustin Hoffman in it, Robert De Niro. Shortly before an election, just to set it up a little bit, this is shortly before an election, a political spin doctor that's played by De Niro, and you'll hear him in just a moment. Also, a Hollywood producer, that's Dustin Hoffman. They join together to fabricate a war in order to cover up a presidential sex scandal. Now, in this little minute-long scene we have here, it's very interesting. It's De Niro, as the spin doctor, being accused by a CIA agent that there is no war. Well, here's the spin doctor, played by De Niro, reacting to those claims by the CIA officer.
Let me ask you a simple question. Why do people go to war? Why do they go to war?
I'll play your silly game.
Okay, why do they go to war?
To ensure their way of life.
Would you go to war to do that?
I have.
And if you went to war again, who would it be against? Huh? Your ability to fight a two-ocean war against who? Who? Sweden and Togo? That time has passed. It's over. The war of the future is nuclear terrorism. It is, and it'll be against a small group of dissidents who, unbeknownst perhaps to their own governments, have blah, 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 blah. And to go to that war, you have to be prepared. You got to be alert. The public has got to be alert, because that is the war of the future. And if you're not gearing up to fight that war, then eventually the axe will fall, and you're going to be out in the street. And you could call this a drill. You could call this job security. You could call it anything you like. But I got one for you. You said go to war to preserve your way of life. Well, Chuck, this is your way of life. And if your spy satellites don't see nothing, if there ain't no war, then you can go home and prematurely take up golf, my friend, because there ain't no war but ours.
There ain't no war but ours. 1997, Wag the Dog. Now, it's interesting that this film was released a month before the outbreak of the Lewinsky scandal, and we had the subsequent bombing of a pharmaceutical factory in Sudan by the Clinton administration, which prompted the media to draw comparisons between the film and reality, Kerry.
Right, right. Well, that was Clinton was in the midst of the Lewinsky scandal. Was on the run up to the charges of impeachment that were going to be voted in the House, and we had been attacked by Al Qaeda in multiple places around the world in the previous year or two, and so he is striking back at Al Qaeda, which nobody has ever heard of. Nobody had ever heard the name Osama bin Laden, for instance. Nobody knew who that was. But he attacked Osama bin Laden's camps in Afghanistan and then this pharmaceutical industry in Sudan, thinking that that was how he could kill Osama bin Laden. Now, he failed. The camp had been vacated ahead of time, and it wasn't the right target in Sudan. But Republicans gave him no credit for that. Republicans insisted that he was just trying to divert attention from his own domestic problems with a crisis abroad, because when there's a crisis abroad, the country closes ranks, we rally around the flag, the president gets a bump in approval, and it's unpatriotic to question or challenge a president. And with hindsight, we see that Clinton was perfectly well aware of the stakes and what he needed to do. He just failed. But the Republicans were influenced by the idea that what he was really doing was trying to distract us from his domestic problems.
Kerry Covington and Tim Walsh with us for another few minutes. I wanted to get this email from one of our listeners, Eric. Just read it verbatim. How is it that there are no scandals brought up on the program for Franklin Roosevelt, who spent nearly four terms in office in an era where presidential power was rapidly expanding and therefore opportunity to commit scandal is higher? I vote independent, writes Eric, but I find it interesting that the only Democrat discussed on the program is Clinton. So there is Eric perhaps wishing for more Democrat scandal.
Well, it's certainly the case. He had a mistress. And if he had been president in the 90s, he might have caught in flack for that. John Kennedy would have caught flack for his dalliances. One scandal we did not talk about was Bobby Baker during the Johnson presidency. So Democrats do have their turn at it, but honestly, I'm kind of at a loss to say Roosevelt did.
Exactly. Well, in effect, one might, in retrospect, look back on the incarceration of Japanese, for example, as a scandal. Certainly, it's a policy scandal of sorts. But in fact, what Kerry has alluded to earlier, and that is before Watergate, and certainly up through the Kennedy administration, you have this wall of protection or this agreement between the press and the presidency to protect a president's private predispositions toward whatever. And so Franklin Roosevelt, who, of course, obviously had a mistress and other aspects of his presidency were essentially ignored. Or, for example, the fact that he was a paraplegic. And, in fact, when he was lifted out of automobiles, he was never photographed. There's only two photographs of him in a wheelchair. So, in truth, the public, for most of the lives of people during the Roosevelt administration, were not aware of how limited FDR was in terms of mobility. So that zone of protection and privacy was something that probably even Gary Hart thought he had. And
right.
It was gone by 1976.
Right. Now that you go ahead, Kerry.
Well, I was just going to say, and that zone of protection he's talking about extended beyond politics. We didn't know about Ty Cobb's racism. We didn't know about Babe Ruth. We thought he was a hero. The reporters didn't report on our hero's dark side. And that's what sort of got torn away with Watergate.
Kerry brings up a good point. That is, we've lost that sense of hero worship or pointing to real live individuals. I mean, occasionally it comes up in prose and in text on television. But in truth, we're more skeptical about people. And when we write or read biographies of them, it often talks as much about their flaws as it is about their achievements.
Is that a function also of the changing nature of our media? You talked about Roosevelt never being photographed or published in a wheelchair as a victim of polio. Kerry,
there were no cell phones back then.
Right. We have the rise of social media, the role of the news media now. We've got fake news. Of course, that is the latest facet of our changing media landscape. So how does that fit in here in your thinking, Kerry?
Well, you're right. It just means that politicians are on stage all the time. You remember the governor from Virginia who got caught talking about Makaka when he was going to run for president,
right,
on a phone that some Democrat was at the rally for, and it just blew him out of the Republican race. You just are never allowed to speak a word that isn't calculated and considered that it's going to go out to everyone.
Or Mitt Romney's 47% remark. Surreptitiously recorded at a fundraiser.
Yep. Or Obama grasping their guns and their religion.
Right.
Or
the basket of deplorables. Any number, and it has to do with both the widespread 24/7 news cycle with all types of websites and all types of platforms, YouTube and so forth, as well as cable television and an increase in partisanship. You have the kind of perfect storm to say your entire life is going to be exposed or transparent, which probably drives some people away from running for public office or public service.
Right. When we talk about heroes being allowed to exist because we don't report on their darker side, the implication of what you've just said is we will, and I mean this, and you know the way in which I mean this, we will have no more heroes.
Yeah.
Because they
right.
will all have dark sides
right.
revealed.
We don't believe in hagiography anymore, which is the study of saints. No individual who we hold up as a role model is going to be without flaws. And that seems to be the way we've accepted it, if it's not quite the way we like it.
Yeah, just compare the way we talked about Superman in the 50s and 60s to the way we talk about our Marvel cartoon comic heroes today. They all have dark sides. They all have flaws. And that's what makes them interesting to people. We're not willing to have the leaps over, you know, buildings at a single bound kind of hero anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what our old presidents were.
We've only got a minute or two left, and this is a big topic, I know, so you'll have to cut into it quickly. How unique is the scandal that is currently ongoing and involving a foreign country? We're in the midst of it. It's hard to make any judgments. That's not what we're doing this hour. How significant is it that it involves a foreign country in a scandal and an adversarial a foreign country? Do we have any historical markers there? Iran-Contra? Well,
it's
dealt
not
with
the same thing.
Not
the same thing. No, Iran-Contra, we sold arms to group that we considered terrorists, but we were not using them to advance an election or anything of that sort. I think we don't know what's happening. I mean, I take Trump at his word that he didn't have any involvement at this point until Mueller proves otherwise. But the idea that an adversary of the United States is involved in influencing our election the way we have observed is very troubling, and any connection to one of the candidates makes it doubly so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's no question that there's some very unique elements to it. Obviously, a foreign nation trying to compromise among our most sacred civic enterprises, our election process, the use of technology and cyber warfare against the country is unique. The one thing that I think is common with other crises in the past is the special prosecutor and then also the drip. One indictment after another.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. So many fascinating facets when we look back in presidential history to look at scandal, crimes, indictments. Tim Walch, presidential historian, retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Carrie Covington, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Carrie and Tim, you make such a great team. I think the invitations for a future event will be in the mail at some point soon.
In the mail?
In the email. Maybe chatted to you by texted to
Facebook.
You. I don't know.
Twit.
Thanks. Thanks, Tim and Carrie.
You're welcome.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton, with help today from Robbie Broad. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.